Hey, it's Sarah. The NFL playoffs are right around the corner, and you should all be listening to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny. Every week, Mina, a guest, and Lenny, her dog, discuss the top stories in the league and look ahead to the weekend's premier matchups. Check out the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny wherever you get your podcasts. ESPN's Debatable is a digital exclusive series across the network's Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube channels and the ESPN app, and it's now available as a podcast. The innovative series is led by a rotating team of signature voices, many of whom you're familiar with on ESPN podcasts, including me. And we take on the most compelling topics from around the sports world. Check out Debatable now wherever you listen to your podcasts. Welcome to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain, a podcast about, well, whatever the hell I want. Actors and musicians, athletes, comedians, neuroscientists, wine experts. If I find somebody interesting, I'm bringing them to you. We'll talk about how they became who they are, how they found success, battled failures, and how they ended up here talking to me. Hey, everybody. Hope you had a great long break. I hope you got a break. And I hope you're excited about the start of a new year, or at least hopeful. Maybe excited is not a good choice at this point. Maybe trepidatious and potentially fearful of what's to come is accurate, but let's be hopeful anyway. If you listen to my last podcast with photographer Robin Lindemann, her life changed when she was diagnosed with a genetic disorder that will slowly cause her to lose her eyesight. And we talked about the idea of lightning bolt moments, or these organic pivot points in life, a diagnosis, a heart attack, a death, an accident, the birth of a baby, things that cause us to rethink everything and allow for what tends to be a more immediate and painless change of habits and behaviors. That thing makes it easier for us to change something we've always wanted to or that we need to. And it's really hard to make that happen without it being organic, without that lightning bolt moment. And you'll hear in this episode just how difficult it is to force those moments. But I've been thinking about it, and I would argue that we're all sort of in the midst of one now, a prolonged lightning bolt moment, to be sure, a long, somewhat exhausting series of lightning bolts. But if we harness it correctly, maybe this moment has the potential to provide that push that we've all been looking for, whether that's some combination of cancellations and schedule changes, habits, perspective changes. So much about our lives and how we knew them is different now. And so it might be the perfect time to look at how we spend our time, who we spend it with, how we feel about our lives, our jobs, our hobbies, our choices, and decide if we want to change them and decide if this is enough of a pivot point in our lives to do so. I've had friends leave jobs after 2 decades, move to new countries, quit their jobs and start their own business. There are so many people sort of looking at the moment and saying, why not now? Because of the perspective that the pandemic sort of allowed them. And instead of saying one day, which they've said forever, they're looking at today and saying, this is day one for whatever's to come next. So I wanted to take an interview from a couple years ago and revisit it. It's with author Gretchen Rubin, and it tackles big picture habit change. So how we eat, exercise, spend our money, spend our time, all of that stuff, the big macro of what we do every single day, sort of what habits and behaviors make up our day. So let's start there. Start thinking about the things you've always wanted to change in your daily habits and behaviors and ask why you still haven't. As I quoted last week, because it really hit me, from therapist Tori Oletto, who runs the Instagram NY Therapist, quote, "People always ask me, how do I change something I know is unhealthy for me? And my response is by understanding why you are choosing it in the first place." So let's start there, right? Take a really hard look at why you keep making the choice of something that you tell yourself you don't want anymore for yourself, that every year you write down in your intentions or your resolutions to not do or to change, and you keep doing. What is that thing that keeps bringing you back to it? And I think this interview is a great look at how your personality type can determine the best approach for you to finally make that change. Also useful tricks like pairing and stuff that make it more likely that you stick with the change. That's for today. I want to let you know in an upcoming episode, we're going to tackle a more specific kind of change, a positive one. Because research shows that we put off really positive things, too, for a number of reasons. So if there's a goal, a hobby, a lesson, a race, a decision that you've been putting off, even positive, I want you to think about it. The pleasurable stuff that you say, one day I'll do that, or eventually, or sometime. Because sometimes, you know, we'll fear failure, or we'll be worried about trying something new. We get so used to being proficient that it's hard to imagine being a beginner at anything. Maybe we want to save money or time, or we think sometime, someday in the future is going to be better. The conditions will be better. You'll be richer. You'll be skinnier. You'll be prettier. You'll be happier. You'll be paired off. Whatever it is, that thing you tell yourself about that arbitrary day in the future, when you're going to do this thing, and why you keep putting it off. So I'm going to stop putting off something I've been talking about doing for a decade plus. And I want you to do the same. I'll tell you all about it in an upcoming episode. But your assignment is two parts. One is the macro, as you're listening to this episode, the everyday habits, behaviors, things that you are considering changing, and how maybe taking that information will help you do it. And then the micro, the one thing you'd like to try to learn, see, attempt, do. And I want to pick some folks to hold accountable and check in with to see if they're really following through and doing the thing. So if you think of it now, you can email me, sarah.c.spain@espn.com. Sarah with an H, dot C, dot Spain at ESPN.com. If you know the thing you've been wanting to learn or try or see or attempt, and you want to put a date on the calendar and a plan in place to do it, message me, let me know. Maybe you could be a part of this crew of folks that I'm going to try to gather together virtually, not actually gather, but gather to conversate, to talk about, to get through all this stuff together. So this is important help that I also need from you now. I need a name for this endeavor, this group of us that will be tackling the things. I have some little ideas I'm thinking of. The Do Crew seems fitting for, that's what she said. The Fuck It List instead of Bucket List. That's what we did for real this time. I need you to help me out with some ideas. So do you like any of those? Any of them hitting you? Or do you got a new name for this group or this endeavor? Let me know. Okay, so back to today's guest, though. Gretchen Rubin, the best-selling author of books on habits, happiness, human nature, including The Happiness Project, Better Than Before, Happier at Home, Outer Order, Inner Calm, and several others. She also has a weekly podcast, Happier with Gretchen Rubin, and a daily blog, GretchenRubin.com. She joined me back in October of 2019 to talk about habit changing, happiness, and more. So here's a big chunk of that great interview.
That's what she said.
How do you end up deciding whether it's through life or study or realizing what you're interested in, that you're going to do the Happiness Project and become someone who wants to write about human nature in a more genuine way?
You know, it started out just for me. I was finishing up my JFK biography, and I had some sort of intellectual downtime, and I was stuck in a city bus in the pouring rain, and I thought, what do I want from life anyway? And I thought, I want to be happy. But I realized I didn't spend any time thinking about whether I was happy or if I could be happier. And I thought, I should have a happiness project. And it hit me like that, happiness project. I ran out to the library the next day, got a huge stack of books, and started researching happiness. What is happiness? Can you make yourself happier? Could I make myself happier? And at first, it was just something I was researching for my own interest, you know, my own kind of edification. But it was such a fascinating and limitless subject that before long I started thinking, wow, well, maybe this should be my next book. And I called it The Happiness Project because really when I had that first idea, that's what I called it in my own mind. And then from then, and it is such a vast and limitless subject that I've basically stayed in that area ever since. And that was 10 years ago.
And if I remember correctly, you considered yourself pretty happy when you wrote it, yes?
Yeah, you know, most people in the world say they're either pretty happy or very happy, and I was pretty happy. So I wasn't starting from a place of despair, but I definitely also had the feeling that there was probably some low-hanging fruit, that if I thought about it, I could probably come up with some things that would make me happier, and indeed I did. I found a lot of things that, you know, without a lot of time, energy, or money, really did boost my happiness, and it just seems like, why wouldn't you do the things that you could do to boost
right.
your happiness?
I say that a lot on this podcast, and I was talking to Yale professor Lori Santos about this because one of the biggest frustrations for her in teaching a class on happiness and psychology and the good life is you can tell people what to do and why to do it, and they can know that it will make their lives happier and more satisfying, and they still won't do it. So what are the tricks our brain sort of plays on us in order to keep us from doing the things that will make us happier? And I think once you've embraced a lot of them and they work, you're like wanting to tell everyone, right? And I feel like that's what this book was you being like, wait, everybody, I figured a bunch of stuff out. Come and hear it and then do it. But it also means a lot of people do come to you, and you started being regularly on your website and doing sort of exercises with people and soliciting people's thoughts and feedback for future books. Has that been a blessing, but also sort of a curse in terms of feeling that you need to be responsive and interactive with all those people?
You know, for me, it's really wonderful because, first of all, it's like the biggest research, you know, cohort you could ever imagine. So I'm just constantly hearing from people about what their challenges are, what works for them. If I throw out an idea, I see what people respond to. Sometimes I can predict what will resonate, and sometimes I'm surprised. And so that's really exciting for me. So I feel like it really feeds my imagination and it's sort of my sense of my subject. It can get overwhelming when you just feel like there's a lot to, just like everybody, it's like a lot of email, there's a lot to kind of manage. I don't have any negative experiences with, like, people being, you know, inappropriate or ugly in any kind of way. So I haven't had to deal with sort of any dark side. And usually it's only to the better, because whenever I'm writing about things, I feel like I have such a deeper sense of human nature, because I've heard from so many people who have experiences that are different from mine. For instance, one thing, so I'm an abstainer, which means when I'm facing a strong temptation, it's easier for me to have none. Like, I can have no cookies, but I can't have one cookie. But then there are moderators, and moderators do better when they have a little bit, or they have it sometimes. You know, they have, like, I'll have a bar of fine chocolate in my desk drawer, and every day or two I'll have one square, and I just want a little bit. And I thought I was the only abstainer in the world. Well, because everybody's always saying, be moderate, follow the 80-20 rule, you should be able to manage yourself. And then when I put this out there, and I'm like, you know what, I can't. It's too hard for me. It's much easier for me to just give it up altogether. I quit sugar. You wouldn't believe the stuff that I quit, because it's just easier for me not to have it at all. Well, once I put that out into the world, I realized a huge number of people, maybe half of people, are abstainers like me. But sort of culture was saying, oh, be moderate. It's like, well, it doesn't work for me. I'd rather give up something altogether than to try to have a little bit. It's too hard for me to have a little bit. And so part of it is just by being able to put ideas out there, then I get all this response, which then also helps me understand people better.
One of the favorite things that I liked about your book, Better Than Before, which is really about how do you cultivate and change habits, is the idea that you understand and express that everybody's different. So you can get all sorts of suggestions from people, and they can work great for one person and not for someone else. And one of those were what you said. Are you an abstainer? Are you a moderator? And then I believe what turned into your next book, Four Tendencies, was this understanding that everybody falls into one of the four. And that's part of Better Than Before. I love this aspect of it because I think it really does help decide the changes that you would want to make to establish a habit. So can you talk about the four tendencies?
Oh, I would love to. One of my favorite subjects. So, so the four tendencies is a framework that I came up with that, as you say, divides people into four categories: upholders, questioners, obligers, and rebels. And I will now explain it briefly. And the fact is, most people know what they are right away. It's not hard. This is not a subtle test. But if you want to take a quiz that will give you an answer, you can go to quiz.gretchenrubin.com or just search quiz Gretchen Rubin. Like, more than 2 million people have taken this quick. It's free. It's really quick. But like I say, a lot of times people don't even need to go take the test because they know what they are. So what it's looking at is how a person responds to expectations. And we all face two kinds of expectations. Outer expectations, which are like a work deadline or a request from a friend. And then there are inner expectations, like my own desire to keep a New Year's resolution, my own desire to get back into playing tennis. And depending on how you respond to outer and inner, that's what determines whether you're an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, or a rebel. So upholders readily meet outer and inner expectations. They meet the work deadline. They keep the New Year's resolution without much fuss. They want to know what other people expect from them, but their expectations for themselves are just as important. So their motto is, discipline is my freedom. Then there are questioners. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do something if they think it makes sense. They resist anything arbitrary, inefficient, unjustified. So what they're doing is they're making everything an inner expectation. If it meets the inner standard, they'll do it. If it fails their inner standard, they will push back. So their motto is, I'll comply if you convince me why. Then there are obligers. Obligers readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. Like a friend of mine who said, well, I don't understand it. When I was in high school, I was on the track team, and I never missed track practice. So why can't I go running now? Well, when she had a team and a coach expecting her to show up, she had no trouble. But when she was trying to go on her own, it was a challenge. And the thing about obligers is the only way they can meet inner expectations is by creating some form of outer accountability. If you want to read more, join a book group. That's how it works for obligers. So their motto is, you can count on me, and I'm counting on you to count on me. Then finally, rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. They can do anything they want to do, anything they choose to do. But if you ask or tell them to do something, they are very likely to resist. And typically, they don't even like to tell themselves what to do. Like, they won't sign up for a 10 a.m. spin class on Saturday because they're like, I don't know what I want to do on Saturday. And just the idea that someone expects me to show up annoys me. And their motto is, you can't make me, and neither can I. So in a nutshell, those are the four tendencies.
Well, and that one I feel bad for in the book, because very often you're left saying, this doesn't really work for rebels, because it's really hard to create something if the very basic nature of them is to not want to follow any sort of system. So here's the thing. You said this is very easy. I found this very hard. According to your quiz, I was a questioner, but
well,
I considered...
Can I just say, the fact that you're like, this is very hard, I would have guessed that you're a questioner, because questioners are like... You can't put all of human nature into four categories. I'm a little bit of everything.
And that is exactly what
I do. What makes sense at the time. They don't understand. That's what it is to be a questioner. So just by saying that, I'm like, she's probably a questioner.
Right, because I thought I was an upholder. But here's my problem, and this is my question for you. Throughout the book, I found that certain things I could say, yes, this absolutely makes sense. I'm an upholder when it comes to morality and principle. I expect other people to act a certain way, and when they want me to act a certain way, it's very important to me that they feel like I'm living up to their expectation. I show up when I want to. I try not to be late. I don't bail. Same with me, though. If there's something that's just, if you put me in a room and no one would know what I did, I would still want to act a certain way. But then there are certain outliers where I'm like, why can't I be an upholder for that? You know, certain things, whether that's doing my physical therapy exercises that I don't really like, even though I know I'm supposed to, or eating healthier when I go out to a restaurant and I tell myself, no matter what you see on the menu and you like, just get the healthy thing. And I can't do it, even if no one else is there. And I'm not, you know, relying on anyone. So what do you tell people? Do you have to pick and choose for certain things what your tendency is? Or do you have to assume that you're that all the time?
Well, I do think that I believe in the genetic roots of personality. So I do think this is part of who you are. I don't think you're one at 20 and one at 40. I don't think you're one at work and one at home. I don't think you're one with your physical therapist and one, you know, with morality. I think we could probably probe a little bit about your experiences and understand how you could harness the questioner tendency to get yourself to do a better job. For instance, with your physical therapy, I would say, are you 100% convinced that this is necessary and that the way that you're being trained is the most efficient? And do you have absolute faith in the judgment and expertise of your PT person?
I actually genuinely do.
So you actually genuinely think that you need to do this?
Yes.
And you think that this person is training you in the most efficient and best way?
Yes, this is like my seventh doctor, and I really trust this one. I just don't prioritize it compared to other things that are more necessary in that moment.
Would you say to you that you're trying to optimize your efficiency?
Probably. I would say I just put work above everything, and then everything else kind of becomes, uh-oh, I didn't get to that.
Okay. So I would say as a questioner, what you should really do is sit down and do the analysis of whether that is the most efficient and best use of your time over the long run. Because are you going to have pain? Are you going to have limited function? Are
yes.
you going to have, yes. Is it going to affect your abilities? Like, is it going to make your performance lower? And really think through the consequences of your action. Because if you are a questioner, usually once questioners are really convinced that this is what they want and this is the best way to get what they want, usually their actions follow. So I just wonder if in the end you just are not totally convinced that you have to do this or commit to this in this way or that it really matters.
Okay. I'm gonna look into
that.
You're
like, you know, sure I should go. Because you said I should go. I should go is somebody is saying that I should go. That's not like I know I need to go. I know that I want to have the benefits of physical therapy. And Better Than Before, that book, I identified the 21 strategies people can use to make or break their habits. And as you say, some work much better for some people than they do for others. So you have to pick and choose what works for each individual. For questioners, the strategy of clarity is the most important one. Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this in this way? What is the purpose of this? Mm-hmm. You just don't sound that convinced.
Right. I got to work on that. I'm like, I quit soda. I quit fast food. Like, I quit all the things that in my brain I could say, here's why. This is not real food. This is terrible. This is chemicals. Why am I doing this? But I can't do that with other. Yeah, I got to work on that. Okay, but this is not a personal therapy session.
Maybe you need to think about the value of your time. What is the value of your time?
Yeah.
What's the highest and best use of your time? Because you might say, well, if I do this now, then I'll reap all the benefits in the future. If I don't do this now, I'm just going to be getting myself into more and more visits to the doctor, interventions. Like, really, it's most efficient for me to deal with this now, which is the thing about a lot of physical therapy. You can do a little bit now or you can do a lot later. It's sort of like, you know, or you might never. My husband blew off his physical therapy and his knee is totally crooked and it's caused lots of problems for years because he blew it off in college. It's like, yeah, don't make that mistake.
We'll get right back to the interview, but first,
you're gonna learn today.
The word of the week is this week. The word honors sort of what many of us did over the long Christmas New Year's break. For those of us lucky enough with time off, a lot of hibernating, eating, sleeping, binging TV, and cleaning. And I know I'm not alone in having tackled some big projects. For me, included a whole closet clean. I found some diamond earrings I thought I lost a few years ago, so score on that. And also tackling the tower of books, multiple towers actually, on my bedside table. And I'm the person who definitely has a full stack to read and keeps buying new ones, sort of suspending disbelief that I pretending I live in a world where I have time to get to all of them. So this word spoke to me. Sundoku. 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 It's a Japanese word, and it means acquiring reading materials but letting them pile up in one's home without reading them. Also refers to books ready for reading later when they're on a bookshelf. Originated as slang in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and translated directly basically means reading pile. So, in a sentence, despite taunting me with the promise of reading I don't currently have time for, my Sundoku still sparks joy, just from the bookshelves now instead of my bedside table. Now let's get back to the interview.
So one of the other things you talk about is that certain people are able to sort of say, and you don't really give people an option on this one. You're like, don't say I'm going to start on New Year's or the first day of this month or as soon as this happens. Today is the best day to start anything. How do you explain that to someone who does, for whatever reason, prefer to work in this sort of framework of this is a better day to do this?
Well, I will say that there are auspicious days, and people like almost never like start a diet in midweek or something. So if there is a day that feels very auspicious to you, okay. But what happens is that a lot of times when people are like, there's this loophole called the tomorrow loophole, which is it doesn't matter what I do right now because starting tomorrow I'm going to be so great. And like if you look at people just to take dieting because this has been so researched, people who think that they're going to start a diet late, in a few days or in a week or whatever, they eat terribly right now.
Right.
So it's like, well, then you're just, that's not good. So the reason why starting now is good is once you're ready, begin now. Don't wait. Don't have a fantasy that everything's going to be easier tomorrow or that, like, you know, you're going to be – or, like, people are like, well, I'm going to totally bust my budget in December, but then in January I'm going to be great. Well, you're the same person in January. You're going to have exactly the same temptations. But if there is some date, there is something where people feel like this is the right day to start. But I just would be mindful of that. It can become a loophole that people use to excuse bad behavior or, you know, self-indulgent behavior. But now, what's that old adage? The best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time is today.
Yeah.
Same thing with a good habit. The best time to start exercising is 20 years ago.
Right.
Second best is today.
Best time to start PT was in college.
It's just going to be it's going to be far more auspicious. Okay. You know.
Right. You mentioned loopholes. That was another fascinating section for me because I recognized myself and so many people in the ways that we say, if I do this, then I get this reward. And you did some interesting research on how people actually were much more successful at habit changing and goals when they did it without the reward being some finish line or you know, act that was specific.
Yeah, rewards are very, very tricky in habit formation, and which is funny because a lot of people think that's kind of a go-to thing, which is, oh, reward yourself for this good habit, and that's going to be helpful. But in fact, there's just research showing that when you reward behavior, you create all kinds of distortions because a lot of times people they'll do it for the reward for a while, but then even if they keep getting the reward, they'll stop doing the behavior, or they feel they don't want to do it. Like they did this really interesting research with little kids. Little kids love to color. If you reward little kids for coloring, they will only color if you reward them, and the quality of their coloring goes down. Because what you're teaching them is no one would color unless there's a reward. And so you're sort of teaching yourself, if you're like, okay, you know, if I do yoga 5 times out of a week, then I get to have a scone. What you're teaching yourself is like, the only reason somebody would do yoga is to do a scone. And then pretty soon the day is going to come when you're like, you know what, it's not worth the scone.
Right.
Or even worse, you're going to say, you know what, I was feeling kind of sick a couple of days. I think I should get my scone anyway, even though I only went to yoga for 2 times a week. This is what starts to happen frequently. And so what's a better kind of reward is the reward where it takes you deeper into the habit. So the reward for coloring is more crayons. The reward for doing yoga is, hey, you need a new yoga mat because you've been doing so much yoga. Or you need new yoga tights because with all the yoga you've been doing, wouldn't it be nice to have like some nice gym clothes or whatever? It's a reward that takes you deeper into the habit. It's not irrelevant to the habit. It's only useful insofar as it supports the habit. And then, of course, there's the reward of doing whatever it is. Yoga makes me feel great. I love the relaxed feeling I have after yoga. I will go to yoga because it's so important to me to have that great feeling that I get from yoga.
Yeah. And so much of this reflects back on what I mentioned in my conversation with Lori Santos is once we convince ourselves that something isn't going to have the result we expect, then we kind of talk ourselves out of doing things, even when we know they make us happy or they make us feel better or healthier. One of the things you also talk about is this lightning bolt. And I think so many of us wish that we could manufacture a lightning bolt. Yes. So kind of explain that theory, and have you discovered any ways to mildly manufacture that?
I don't. So sadly, as I said, in Better Before, I lay out all the strategies that people use to make or break habits. And a strategy that's often overlooked because it's very different from the other 20. And as you say, you kind of can't invoke it. It's something that happens to you. So in a way, it's just sort of luck if you experience the lightning bolt. Lightning bolt is when you get some piece of information or something changes in your life, you're hit with some big realization, and suddenly everything changes. So the most obvious example is like somebody I know was a doctor, and he said, I will talk to people who are like, there's no way I could give up drugs. I've been doing drugs for years. And they get pregnant, and bang, they give up drugs overnight because they're like, I can't be pregnant and be doing drugs. And he says, it's just amazing. But like you would have thought it wasn't possible, and overnight they do it. I have a friend where his son was born and he quit smoking because he's like, now I'm a father. I can't smoke anymore. And it was sort of like effortless. It just happened. And for me, I experienced the lightning bolt because I read this book by Gary Taubes called Why We Get Fat. Because I was interested in insulin, not even why we get fat. I was really interested in insulin. And it just completely convinced me that I should give up sugar, give up carbs. And overnight, I changed everything about the way I ate. I mean, just no substitutions, no gradual modifications, just overnight. And I gave up huge amounts of stuff, flour, sugar, pasta, starchy
Happiness.
Vegetables, fruit. Huh? Yeah. But it was because this book, all of a sudden, it was just overnight because my idea changed. And so the lightning bolt, I think it's important to understand the lightning bolt, because I think sometimes when people experience it, they don't recognize it and they don't take advantage of it. And sometimes they kind of, they don't even, it doesn't even really feel legitimate to them. Like I have a friend who quit sugar when she was pregnant, and then, and she loved it and she was really happy about it. But then her baby was born, and then she sort of slipped back into eating sugar without really meaning to. I think if she had mindfully understood what had happened, she might have been like, oh, I want to commit to this and keep this going. I had a really easy time getting into it, but now I want to sustain it. Instead, right. she sort of didn't know, have a framework for understanding it, so she didn't stick with it. And then she didn't have that same lightning bolt. So the first time it was really easy. But right. That's another thing about habits. Starting over is often much harder than starting. People often find it pretty easy to do something the first time, so they think, well, this will always be easy. It's like, no, the second time it's much harder.
Yeah, I want to get
into the lightning bolt. Yeah. I mean, people say to me, oh, I read that book too, but I didn't get the lightning bolt. Or, you know, people want to have, because it's so easy. It's
right.
The easiest way to change habits.
Well, and it's cumulative. Like, it feels like a lightning bolt. But, you know, when I wanted to quit soda, I'd already thought about it for a long time. And then I saw a video of someone using Coke to clean the rust off a car. And I was like, yeah, I think I'm done now. That's not something I want to put in my body.
People will point to documentaries.
Yeah.
Or it can even be, it can be like, something a doctor says. Sometimes people, like, it's like when they hear the words, like, you are officially pre-diabetic, they're
right.
Like, oh my gosh, now everything, like, you've been telling me for years I should do this, I should do that, but somehow now that I'm officially in that zone, everything feels different. Maybe somebody else in your family has some kind of health crisis, and you're like, oh my gosh, this is real. Different thing, even sometimes it's something like a milestone birthday, can kind of shake people up, but it's frustrating because you think, oh, I'd love to just like have this thing hit me on the head. Because like you said, then you just give up Coke overnight. It doesn't even feel hard. It's just like, oh yeah, I don't want to do that anymore.
Yeah.
And it's just like, okay, done. It's not that uncommon actually. It's much more common than I think people realize, but it's still not something that you can invoke.
Right. Let's talk. We might have skipped the most important part, which is sort of an understanding of habits themselves, fixed habits, unfixed habits, why they're hard to change in the first place, and why in the end it should be something you don't have to think that hard about. So kind of get to the basics of what, when you were writing this book, what you were first tackling as far as the idea of a habit.
Yeah, well, habits are super important because they are, like, they shape about 40% of everyday life. And so they're the invisible architecture of our ordinary day. And we all know this, that if we have habits that work for us, we're a lot more likely to be happier, healthier, more productive, and more creative. And if our habits don't work for us, that's going to be a lot harder. And I got interested in habits because people often talk about self-control or willpower. Self-control and willpower are hard. They're draining. But if you have a habit, you don't have to use self-control or willpower. You just have these things on automatic. You don't have to get up and debate with yourself whether to go to the gym. You just get up and go. Just the way you brush your teeth. You do not say to yourself things like, oh, gosh, maybe I'll brush my teeth in the afternoon because I'll have more energy then. Or I've been so good about brushing my teeth, I think I deserve a day off. Or I'm going to start brushing my teeth on Monday, I don't have to brush my teeth today. Or given the kind of boss that I have, how could anybody expect me to brush my teeth? You just brush your teeth. You know, it just happens. So the more that we can make things habits, the more we get ourselves out of this kind of self-control and willpower, energy drain, decision fatigue, should I, shouldn't I, now, later, 1, 2, 3, it makes it hard to do what we want to do because it's draining. And so habits can put good behaviors on autopilot, and then that just frees us up to use our self-control and our willpower for other things, like not losing our temper with our children or handling a difficult boss with composure. These are things that require a lot of self-control and a lot of willpower, but if we're not exhausting it on things like, am I going to go for a walk around my neighborhood before I go to work because I just get up and do that, well, then I'm gonna have more energy for other kinds of kind of one-off drains on myself.
Yeah. It's kind of amazing how easy habits are when they are things you don't think about. And I try to put things right next to my toothbrush, like, oh, I want to take these probiotics. And I still don't do it. And it's sitting right next to it because my brain has to think to take them instead of do the thing that I'm so used to, which is pick this up, put the toothpaste down, and be done with it.
Okay, so here's my suggestion.
Okay.
Say that you can't brush your teeth until you've taken the probiotics.
Mm,
like, put
okay.
the toothbrush behind the bottle.
Right.
You can't. That's the strategy of pairing. But you put the thing that you want to do second. You know,
very smart. Yeah.
Or put it in your morning, like have a mug next to your coffee pot and put the bottle inside the mug. And then you're like, I can't pour coffee in this mug until I've taken my vitamins or my medication or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking of having like a little box and everything in there is morning. And I have to do everything in the box before I can leave the bathroom. And everything
that's
in the box
a great
at
idea.
Night is
that's
a night box.
Because you're right. What happens with things is they just become wallpaper and you don't even see them.
Yes.
So they don't act as visual cues. So you have to make some kind of behavior cue. But yeah, there's a lot. But that's a great example because there's a lot of ways to tackle that. Once you say, look, it's not that I need to have more willpower. I need to put myself first. I need to learn to like be more motivated. I have to have more self-care. That's what my problem is. That's why I'm not taking these probiotics. It's like, no, I just need to set this up in a different way. I'll try
yeah.
this. I'll try that. Maybe I need a little experimentation. What works? I'll buy time caps. I'll buy, you know, there's, but once you say, okay, how do I set this up slightly differently to see if I get a better result? We could generate 10 ideas in a second.
Right.
Things to try.
And just try them and see.
You try another, and then you get to something that works. But I think a lot of times people blame themselves. What's wrong with me? Everybody else can do it. What's my problem? I need to change. No. You don't. Whatever you're dealing with, other people are dealing with too. Change your circumstances. Set things up in a different way.
Right. It's more about what works for you than it is that everyone's doing it right. It's more what works for
yes.
you. It's kind of the clarity of action thing, right?
Well, and I think people really beat themselves up. I mean, people say to me, I can't use a to-do list. I'm not a real grown-up. Why is it that everybody else can use a to-do list? I'm like, no, that's a rebel thing. Rebels don't like to-do lists. They've got all kinds of workarounds because they don't like to use to-do lists. You know, and it's like they also don't like schedules. It's like, yeah, you're not going to want to sign up for a weekly exercise training thing. Don't do that. That's not going to work for you. Because there's nothing wrong with you. That's just you got to find a different solution. Obligers, they have to have outer accountability. And obligers will say to me, well, I don't want to have outer accountability. I want to be able to just do it on my own. And I'm like, that's not going to work for you. I'm just here to say it's not going to work for you. It's never worked in the past. That's why you're super frustrated. Set up outer accountability and this problem will be solved tomorrow. Why not take the easy, quick solution?
Right.
Outer accountability. The biggest tendency is obliger. So you're in big, good company. Many, many hugely successful people are obligers. There's nothing wrong with you. Just set it up in a different way. Get yourself the outer accountability, and you'll be able to achieve any aim that you want. And it's very easy to get yourself outer accountability once you realize that's what you need.
Right. And I would imagine there are people who are questioners who also are great when they give themselves obliger things. Like, I don't like to bail on people. I care a lot what people think about whether I'm doing the things that I say that I will. And I'm, you know.
That's values. Those are values.
Yeah, that's values. And so that makes me someone who works well when I'm accountable as well. When I have other people watching and seeing if I succeed at the things or do the things I say I'm going to do. Which I think is one also thing that's hard for people. You have to really want to change in order to say, I'm going to, a colleague of mine who actually came on the podcast and said, you know, I've beaten cancer twice and I don't take care of my body. I want to be healthier as somebody who's already been lucky enough to do that twice. And he started putting every meal and every workout on his Instagram just to say,
yeah.
Listen, everyone's going to watch me do this.
Yeah.
And if I fall and fail, it's you all saw me not do the thing I said I wanted to do. And he's lost like 130 pounds.
I bet he's an obliger. That's because that's an obliger problem and an obliger solution.
Yeah.
Whenever anybody talks about self-care, they're probably an obliger. When anybody talks about spontaneity, they're probably a rebel. Whenever anybody talks about arbitrariness, they're probably a questioner.
Huh.
But people talking about self-care and people talking about I need to give outer accountability in order to meet my aims for myself, that's probably an obliger. So I would bet 85% that your coworker is an obliger.
So I love all this stuff. I find it so fascinating. I really recommend to people to read Better Than Before if they want to kind of figure out their tendency and the best ways for them to tackle their various habits. And then, of course, if you still haven't read The Happiness Project, there's so many interesting stuff in there. I remember the Happiness Project. There were certain things I was like, I already do that. I'm on top of that. And then it made me like immediately go to the Container Store. It was such a weird, the part that was about organizing for me was like, this is the first action I'm taking as a result of this book, is like getting my life better in order. What were the biggest takeaways for you, and maybe the ones you heard the most about from other people from that book?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that one, because I just wrote a little book called Outer Order, Inner Calm, because to a very surprising degree, many people are like, oh my gosh, when I get my stuff in order, I feel so much better.
Yes.
You know, a friend of mine said, I finally cleaned out my fridge and now I know I can switch careers. And I'm like, I know how that feels. You know, so I think there is this weird kind of disproportionate connection for a lot of us between having things orderly in our environment and feeling kind of that sense of focus and control and potential. And that was definitely surprising to me, because I felt that way myself, but I didn't realize that that was something that many people experienced. Another thing that was really surprising to me, like I really surprised myself, and I've heard from many people for whom this is true, is that I love mastery, I love familiarity, but what I realize is that doing things that are novel and challenging actually bring happiness. And like I started my podcast, Happier, with my sister, and I remember calling her and saying, this could be a huge flop, it's going to be a lot of work, are you sure you're up for this? She's like, 100%. And it was, we felt insecure, we were drained, it was so much work, and yet it's this huge engine of happiness for me, for both of us. And so I was surprised to see that the research that says novelty and challenge make people happier, even for someone like me who did not think that would be true. Well, yeah, it's true. That's true.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I think is absolutely true, ancient philosophers and contemporary scientists agree, and I think people, everything that I've heard is just emphasized the truth of it, is that in the end, it's relationships that are the most important to happiness, that you have to feel like you belong, you have to feel connected, you have to feel like you can get support and give support, you have to have intimate, deep bonds. And so many people are like, I move all the time, or I've lost touch with my friends, or I'm so busy I don't have time, or I'm in a new place, or, you know, there's a lot of challenges. But anytime there are new kind of manageable solutions or suggestions, people are so excited about that, because I think people really do get that how important relationships are. And so that's something where that was sort of my belief, and that's what the research showed. And certainly as I've engaged with people, in the last 10 years, I've just seen that over and over, that is really at the core.
And it's interesting too. You said earlier, you're someone who doesn't think about the future much. And that is interesting too, in talking about how so much of studies about happiness talk about mindfulness and being present.
Yep.
And
yeah.
If you worry and are anxious too much about what could happen in the future, particularly, again, back to Lori Santos, our expectations of what might happen tend to be deeply flawed. We only think of the best stuff that could happen if we win the lottery, not the bad stuff. We only think of the worst stuff that could happen if we're in an accident or something, become ill, and not the good stuff that comes from that. And so our expectations are so skewed that we're much better being present and being, you know, right now. And I wonder if your happiness in part stems from just naturally being that kind of person.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was talking about the genetic roots of personality, and I think like 50% of happiness is genetically determined, and then 10 to 20% is life circumstances like education, wealth, health, marital status, things like that. And then the rest is very much influenced by our conscious thoughts and actions. And so, you know, I took a test. There's like an online test you can take, and I'm like a 7, so I'm like pretty happy. And I think I'm still a 7, like when I'm lying in bed at night or like sitting on the subway. But what I have found is that by doing all these things, I've really made the experience of my life much happier. So I think part of it is who I was, just like my natural feelings about the future or sense of optimism or sense of self-mastery, self-efficacy, those kinds of things. And then part of it is just, you know, really grappling with the idea, like, I'm going to feel better if I get more sleep. That is really true, and I need to go to sleep then. Or, you know, it's like not enough just to, you said this earlier, it's not enough just to know it intellectually. I have to act on it in order to get the benefit. So really, like, doing those things I think really did help.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's interesting, there was like a mild loophole that you said you know, somebody wrote you, I think, and said, I know I want to go to sleep, but also my husband and I, our time to really be together and share time is once you put the kids to bed and we feel like that's the only time we have in our day. So if we want to stay up an hour late because we connect and talk and have a snack, even if it's not ideal, that ends up feeling better than making the smart quote unquote choice of going to bed early.
Well, it's one of those, I mean, that's what happens a lot of times with habits, and I think that's why sometimes a habit doesn't stick, is that you really have two values that are both important that are competing. One is I want to get more sleep. Two is I want to hang out with my husband and have a couple's time. They're both important values. And so I think I think different people would make different choices. And you might make different choices at different times in your life. But the thing is to say, well, how do I think about this rather than just defaulting into it? And it's also like, okay, it's one thing if we're staying up and engaging with each other, but maybe he's out of town and I'm just watching, you know, reruns of The Office rather than going to sleep. You know what I mean? It's sort of like really being aware, but you talked about mindfulness, really being aware of what we're doing. Are our habits working for us? Do they need to change? What are the values that we're serving? Then we can make better choices.
That's what she said.
Oh, yeah. One more thing. This is a place where I rant, I rave, everything in between. I tell you to read something, watch something, listen to something, whatever's on my mind. And I already told you today, you've got assignments, people. You need to think about the everyday habits and behaviors you want to change and how you might change them. Think about why you haven't maybe been able to make that change in the past. Figure out your tendencies, which approaches might work for you. And then think about the pleasurable thing that you've been putting off doing, but you really want to do, a place you want to go, a race you want to run, an instrument or a skill or a language you want to learn, and shoot me an email and tell me about it. sarah.c.spain@espn.com. You can always tweet me too, @SarahSpain. I want to start gathering some folks for the Do Crew. Do Crew? Is it? The F*** It List Crew. I don't know. Whatever we decide to name it. That's also your assignment. You need to help me name it. You can always tweet me @SarahSpain if you've got guest suggestions, questions, or more. You should always go to the iTunes or podcast app, subscribe, and follow That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Rate it 5 stars, please, and give me a nice review. Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's What She Said.